Competition is only for the little guy. That's a divide and conquer mechanism. Shouldn't be applied to larger groups from the point of view of the people that run the Federal Reserve or the people in charge of the savings and loan schemes. The money system is working just fine. We are going to get on to how the money system gives an unaccountable few the keys to the kingdom, the power to make money out of thin air, and how the rest of humanity is locked in a perpetual zero-sum game, and what's more, charged rent for even playing. But for now, I'd like you to focus how those huge profits from the enterprise allowed it to control history as recorded. Not everyone. There's the Pete Brutons out there. There is a trail of muddy footprints that the US deep state left through the path of history, but it's not connected by corporate media. Nowhere in the Times, nowhere in Wikipedia is there anything about this. And yet it makes perfect sense and answers a lot of difficult questions that corporate media never pose. The 80s and 90s was the period of my education, so-called, my schooling, if you rather. It didn't give me a real overview over society. It didn't prepare me for an awareness of what's actually going on. It did school me in a bunch of technical procedures, but for some reason, as of 1999, when I left the University of Warwick, PhD in hand, I didn't feel very inclined to become a soldier for capitalism. So I went to Bangladesh and pursued my own education there, and found that that did give me freedom and peace of mind, an ability to refocus my energies, just in time, in fact, to pick up with Unwelcome Guests study, which Lynn Gehry had started in the year 2000. So let's go back to those days. This is from August 2000, the section of Lynn Gehry's introduction to episode 22.
At the recent protest during the Republican National Convention in Philadelphia, one protester's sign read, "The greatest threat to democracy is the notion that it has already been achieved." That notion is one of the many political myths held by Americans. Some of these myths are: if you work hard, you will do well. And if you've done well, it's because you've worked hard. The notion that we have a free press that serves as the people's watchdog is another. And perhaps the most tragic myth is that the American military defends democracy, and that military service and patriotism are equivalent. The reality is that instead of one person, one vote, this country operates by the $1, one vote principle. The free press is actually a corporate propaganda machine geared toward the manipulation of the electoral process, and it controls public dialogue to coincide with the interests of its corporate owners. The reality is that a janitor or a fruit picker both work very hard, and they can work till they drop. They will always be poor. Most of the people with great wealth work very little. They are wealthy because they are in a position to make others work for them and then keep the profits that the others' work generates. Never in my entire lifetime of more than four decades has the American military been deployed for any reason other than to deny people in a far-off country the right to govern their own affairs and to use their resources as they see fit, instead of remaining cash cows for corporate capital. And the young Americans who have been sent to do the capitalist's dirty work and have lost their lives have been unknowingly paving the way for their livelihoods to be exported to U.S.-backed dictatorships where the citizens are forced to work for starvation wages as part of the process of corporate globalization.
Everybody be careful, everybody be very careful, keep watching your TV. There are people who are laughing with a wink or a nod. There are people who are questioning our great TV God. Everybody be careful, everybody be careful, stay tuned to your TV. There are ponies who are talking, there are...
5:30.
Exotic mind control techniques would not be required for the ultimate goal of controlling the opinions and behavior of the American public. The answer would come in the form of a small, flickering box. The behaviorist Ivan Pavlov was the first scientist to explain why moving images are so attractive to human beings. We instinctively react to any sudden or novel visual stimuli because of our biological orienting system. In evolutionary terms, this was and is necessary both for exploration of our environment and for defense against potential predators. Television not only entertains the mind, it relaxes the body. This has been confirmed by EEG readings of viewers' brainwaves as they watch television programs and advertising. In the hands of skilled media professionals, moving images create an effect roughly akin to hypnosis, producing passivity, a lowered level of alertness, and increased suggestibility.
But some will get through to your home.
During the Cold War and beyond, television programming would increasingly resemble an experiment in fear-based conditioning applied on a global scale. The thesis of John B. Watson that fear, not love, is the guiding force in human society would no longer be confined to the realm of theory. It would become our reality.
There are ponies who are talking, there are wasters who read. There are people here who do not even own a TV. Everybody be careful.
307.
It's very hard to have a self-governing people in a self-governing country when the information flow and the news flow is so controlled by a handful of people.
Of will. Weapons of mass destruction. Destruction. Weapons of mass destruction.
It's telling that back in the 1880s, the Knights of Labor, in their fundamental principles, called for that all transportation of knowledge must be publicly owned.
Their refusal to do so will result in military conflict at a time of our choosing. Weapons of mass, weapons of mass, weapons of mass destruction.
The government has decided to commit Australian forces because we believe it is right.
It is right.
It is lawful, and it's in Australia's national interest.
And again, weapons.
And I think they understood exactly that you can't aspire to a democracy if the transportation of knowledge and communications are in fact privately held.
Today we published a 50-page dossier detailing the history of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction.
And again,
weapons of mass destruction.
Destruction.
Everything I know about my country, I learned on TV. The man on the screen tells me who is our enemy.
581.
The core institutions of the military-industrial complex are the media conglomerate.
They say that we are free and we must fight to be number one. So when the army calls, I'll grab my TV, my car, and my gun. And the TV god watches over me, opens up my eyes.
Whether we're talking about, you know, CBS or Fox or ABC or Disney or Vivendi or, you know, very small number of companies.
TV god watches over me, opens up my eyes, shows me how to see all around the world every night and day on my TV.
If we're going to engage and put all the treasury into this global militarization, then people have to go along with it. Their minds have to be prepared. For instance, when drones, these robots, are going into Pakistan, clearing out whole valleys through, you know, terror, just indiscriminately bombing whole populations, and nobody really takes responsibility because it's computer programmers back in Florida or something doing it. I mean, this is only possible if people back in the United States and Canada and Europe have the sense that those on the receiving end of these weapons, or whether it be Gaza, are not really fully human, that they're terrorists or they're harboring terrorism or their religion breeds terrorism. We talk about environmental contamination. I don't think there's anything as disastrous to humanity at the moment as the way our minds have been contaminated by these media conglomerates who create these mythologies on which the war machine depends.
Where do weapon makers go when the nations are at peace? Where do arms merchants go when the nations are at peace? Where do weapon salesmen go when the nations are at peace? They go in search of enemies.
And as I say, you know, it's not only the media conglomerates, there are public relations companies.
Where do all the generals go when the nations are at peace? Where do cold warriors go when the nations are at peace? Where do CIA directors go when the nations are at peace? They go in search of enemies.
Who design ad campaigns or public relations campaigns, so-called, for wars. The Hill and Knowlton case.
673.
They took the babies out of the incubators.
Is classic. And then, of course, 9/11. The way it's been portrayed, the interpretation given us within 2 or 3 hours, you know, has remained the same to this day. And it is calculated to produce, you know, a never-ending supply of enemies.
Do I not know you? Are you not my people? Is this not the land of the free, the home of the brave? So who are these ones who drag our name across the seas?
And it has demonized the entire Arab world, the entire Muslim world, and created a situation where we almost seem to be in religious wars.
Do you weigh up the pain? Do you weigh up people's lives? In the face of what you stand to gain, is there anything you would sacrifice? How long do you march down my streets in search of enemies?
376.
According to Herman and Chomsky, the media maintains a corporate class bias through 5 filter systems. Concentrated private ownership, a strict bottom line profit orientation, an over-reliance on government and corporate sources for news, a tendency to avoid offending the powerful, and an almost religious worship of the market economy and strongly opposing any alternative beliefs. Governments have always done this. The Clinton administration spent $38 million their last year in terms of public relations. But if we look at it now, Henry Waxman's committee found out that under the Bush administration from 2003 to 2005, was actually an 18-month period, they spent $1.6 billion on PR contracts. And $1 billion of that was the Pentagon. So this is money spent for PR firms, for press releases, for paying journalists to write stories. When we say new American censorship, we have a whole different structural thing. It's beyond simply manufacturing consent of Chomsky and Herman. It has gone into the deliberate manufacturing and control of information in American society.
We've got to turn ourselves to the healing of the land. Focus our attention on the gifts we have at hand. Someday the product of the people will be peace. There'll be no search of enemies. No search of enemies. There'll be no search of enemies.
29.
So there's all sorts of efforts to, you know, manufacture enemies for people to hate, but a foreign enemy is much better.
369.
Edward Bernays, the so-called father of public relations, wrote about an invisible government which is the true ruling power of our country. He was referring to journalism, the media. That was almost 80 years ago, not long after corporate journalism was invented. It's a history few journalists talk about or know about, and it began with the arrival of corporate advertising. As the new corporations began taking over the press, something called professional journalism was invented. To attract big advertisers, the new corporate press had to appear respectable, pillars of the establishment, objective, impartial, balanced. The first schools of journalism were set up, and a mythology of liberal neutrality was spun around the professional journalist. The right to freedom of expression was associated with the new media and with the great corporations, and the whole thing was, as Robert McChesney put it so well, entirely bogus. For what the public didn't know was that in order to be professional, journalists had to ensure that news and opinion were dominated by official sources.
266.
The mainstream media simply will not deal with our issues. Now they will say, well, these are just allegations. These are unproved. But whenever the White House says something that is unproved, just an allegation, you hear about it on the evening news. No, you hear about it within an hour. Unproven allegations that more often than not turn out to be false. So it's not because the allegations are unproved that they don't report them. It's because their corporate owners do not let them report them. The most dramatic recent evidence of this, of course, was the appearance of the first of the Downing Street memos, because many people said, aha, here is the smoking gun. This is absolute proof about what people have been debating for over a year now. Did we cook the intelligence? So surely this is going to be a 4-inch headline that's going to dominate the news for weeks. What we got was absolute silence until people like Ray McGovern, who's here today, and others started forcing the issue into the public consciousness.
In order to be professional, journalists had to ensure that news and opinion were dominated by official sources. And that hasn't changed. Go through the New York Times on any day and check the sources of the main political stories, domestic and foreign. You'll find they're dominated by governments and other establishment interests. That's the essence of professional journalism. I'm not suggesting that independent journalism was or is excluded, but it's more likely to be an honorable exception. Think of the role Judith Miller played in the New York Times in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq. Yes, her work became a scandal, but only after it had played a powerful role in promoting an invasion based on lies. But Miller's parroting of official sources and vested interests was not all that different from the work of many famous Times reporters, such as the celebrated W.H. Lawrence, who helped cover up the true effects of the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima in August 1945. No radioactivity in Hiroshima ruin was the headline on his report, and it was false.
229.
Butler went before the McCormick-Dickstein Committee to reveal the plot. Time magazine and most of the media immediately ridiculed it, and in the front page of the Times, they had a story after making it seem that Butler was off his nut, that he was a kook. And then, about a couple of months later, after the McCormick-Dickstein Committee had checked out and investigated the story and they reported it was 100% validated, it was all true, Time magazine noted this on page 44 in four-point type footnote, four lines at the bottom of a page in four-point type. And that is the kind of treatment that this received, and it is the explanation of why you don't find it in the history books today, and why no schoolboy, even very few college students, are aware of the serious plot which failed. But here was something that happened, a coup that failed in the United States, and nobody knows about it.
Consider how the power of this invisible government has grown. In 1983, the principal global media was owned by 50 corporations, most of them American. In 2002, this had fallen to just 9 corporations. Today, it's probably about 5. Rupert Murdoch has predicted that there will be just 3 global media giants, and his company will be one of them. This concentration of power is not exclusive, of course, to the United States. The BBC has announced it's expanding its broadcasts to the United States because it believes Americans want principled, objective, neutral journalism, for which the BBC is famous. They've launched BBC America. You may have seen the advertising. The BBC began in 1922, just before the corporate press began in America. Its founder was Lord John Reith, who believed that impartiality and objectivity were the essence of professionalism. In the same year, the British establishment was under siege. The unions had called a general strike, and the Tories were terrified that a revolution was on the way. The new BBC came to their rescue. In high secrecy, Lord Reith wrote anti-union speeches for the Tory Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin and broadcast them to the nation, while refusing to allow the Labour leaders to put their side until the strike was over. So a pattern was set. Impartiality was a principle to be suspended whenever the establishment was under threat. And that principle has been upheld ever since. Take the invasion of Iraq.
749.
When I returned to the newsroom at the New York Times in 2003, after denouncing the invasion of Iraq and being publicly reprimanded for my stance against the war, reporters and editors I had known and worked with for 15 years lowered their heads or turned away when I was nearby. Ruling institutions, the state, the press, the church, the courts, academia, mouth the language of morality, but they serve the structures of power, no matter how venal, which provide them with money, status, and authority.
There are two studies of the BBC's reporting. One shows that the BBC gave just 2% of its coverage of Iraq to anti-war dissent. 2%. That's less than the anti-war coverage of ABC, NBC, and CBS. A second study by the University of Wales shows that in the build-up to the invasion, 90% of the BBC's references to weapons of mass destruction suggested that Saddam Hussein actually possessed them, and that by clear implication, Bush and Blair were right.
518.
Now, these were surveys where they went out, the one in 2007 went out, interviewed 2,400 families in Iraq in 15 of the 18 provinces. They didn't go into the most violent ones. And one of the questions was, has someone in your family died from war violence? And they were able to extrapolate from that data at the 99% accuracy level the entire deaths in Iraq. And they said at that time, and this was 2007, that there's been 1 million civilian deaths in Iraq because of the war. Now, these aren't deaths because somebody got sick and died. These were war violence deaths. And this is a million people in excess of what had been the death rate under Saddam Hussein.
306.
The current coverage of the war in Iraq does not expose the pathology of war. We see the war from the perspective of troops who fight the war, or the equally skewed perspective of foreign reporters holed up in hotels, hemmed in by drivers and bodyguards and translators and official minders. There are moments when war's face appears to these voyeurs and professional killers, perhaps from the back seat of a car, or a small child, her brains oozing out of her head, lies dying, but mostly it remains hidden. And all our knowledge of the war in Iraq has to be viewed as lacking the sweep and depth that will come one day, perhaps years from now, when a small Iraqi boy or girl reaches adulthood and unfolds for us the sad and tragic story of the invasion and bloody occupation of their nation.
Now, the Johns Hopkins study also asked people how they died. And their 2006 survey was quite clear that half of them died either by aerial bombing or U.S. firefights. So we've killed 500,000 people. Our forces have killed 500,000 people in Iraq and displaced 5 million more. You won't find those figures in any newspaper in the country. You won't see those figures in any television program. Instead, what we got a year ago, April, was a press release that came out of AP out of Baghdad that said government sources inside Baghdad say that the number of civilian casualties since at that time, they said 2005, were 87,000. And the total civilian casualties for the war were 110,000. Now, that story ran nationwide last April. They re-released the same story in July, and they re-released the same story again in October. That is deliberate lying. That is deliberate top-down propaganda. That's not just avoidance of a story like the torture stop. This is deliberately misinforming us.
We now know that the BBC and other British media were used by the Secret Intelligence Service, MI6, in what they called Operation Mass Appeal.
Any fabricated motivation for war or empire would do as long as it appealed to the collective consciousness of the population at the time.
MI6 agents planted stories about Saddam's weapons of mass destruction, such as weapons hidden in his palaces and in secret underground bunkers. All these stories were fake.
I'm going to make another reference to Operation Mass Appeal in just a minute, but you might want to reflect on this point. What are the implications for a society if one group secretly is permitted to spread whatever lies it deems beneficial and given a massive budget to facilitate its doing that? We continue with a veteran of the show, Michael Parenti, speaking from episode 12, back in the year 2000.
Rupert Murdoch, who probably owns more media in the world than any other individual, owns almost all the media of Australia, was an Australian, came to the U.S., found there were restrictive laws against how much media a non-U.S. citizen can own, so he became a citizen within a month. Most people have to wait a number of years, you know, green card, residency, all that stuff. He got it like that, and owns enormous numbers of newspapers and TV stations. He was interviewed once. Interview was carried in Vanity Fair. The question was, you're considered to be politically conservative. To what extent do you influence the editorial posture of your newspapers? And I thought you'd get that usual blather about, well, of course, I respect the editorial integrity and independence and professionalism of my editors and blah, 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 blah. He didn't say anything like that. He responded with rather refreshing candor. He said, to what extent do I influence my editorial policies of my newspapers? Considerably. My editors have input, but I make the final decision. That's very refreshing, you know, when they come right out and they say what really happens. I do it, understand? You do what I say because I control your career, your job. And my control of your job and your salary gives me control of your mind, too. And if there's some kind of incongruity there and clash, then your mind goes out the door with your butt, you see. The boards of directors of print and broadcast news organizations are populated by representatives from Ford, General Motors, General Electric, General Dynamics, Dow Corning, Alcoa, Coca-Cola, Philip Morris, ITT, IBM, AT&T, and other corporations. So these boards are filled with the representatives of corporate America. That's your free and independent media. You see, the media in this country are not close to corporate America. They're not friendly to corporate America. They're not inclined or biased toward corporate America. They are corporate America.
586.
The media and marketing men spend billions of dollars in research. They have developed an entire science based on the very best psychology and knows exactly which one of our buttons to press to make us swallow an idea or buy a product. And they're not just selling us laundry detergent. They sell us everything from plastic gadgets to warfare. If we are to make decisions about the future of our society, the single most important thing we need is the truth. So I would like us to imagine a nightmare scenario. A powerful group of businessmen with access to the White House, who control the media, and who make obscene amounts of money whenever there is war.
We have a Congress that failed in every way to ask the right questions, to hold the president to account. Our Congress failed us miserably, and that's because many in Congress are beholden to the military-industrial complex.
The defense budget is $750 billion. Profits went up last year well over 25%. I guarantee you, when war becomes that profitable, you're going to see more of it.
We have a process that has a seamlessness where the corporate interests that stand to benefit are so intertwined and interwoven with the political forces that the financial elites and the political elites have become the same people.
They are multinational giant corporations, and their boards are inhabited with the same people who inhabit the boards, these interlocking directorates who inhabit the boards of all the other giant corporations and come from these other corporations. Among the major stockholders of the three largest broadcast networks are Chase Manhattan, J.P. Morgan, and Citibank. NBC is owned by General Electric. CBS is owned by Tisch. ABC, Capital Cities, is owned by Disney. GE and Disney are the two of the most conservative corporations that exist. Fox Network is owned by Rupert Murdoch. What's the free independent media we're talking about? And these people appoint the presidents of the corporations, who appoint the bureau chiefs, who appoint the top editors, who appoint the reporters. If you look at the organization of any news organization, it looks like the army, top-down command right down along the way. And their profits are as high as anything in corporate America, and the degree of merger and concentration is higher than it is in finance capital and in manufacturing capital. The media are highly profitable, highly concentrated.
And the next clip is also from episode 12.
In 1997, Steve Wilson and Jane Acree were investigative reporters employed at Channel 13 in Tampa, Florida, owned by Rupert Murdoch's Fox TV network. They were threatened, offered bribes, ordered to lie, and finally fired when they refused to lie about the health risks of a Monsanto product. In 1998, they filed a lawsuit against Fox TV. The following interview was recorded shortly after their case was filed.
Steve and Jane, thank you for being with us on the program. Can you let our listeners know what happened as a result of you covering this story on bovine growth hormone?
Just to set the record straight here, this was supposed to air originally on February 24th of 1997. And we had been given the green light all along as we were in production with the story. They knew what we were doing. They liked what we were doing. They encouraged us to do so, paid for a lot of travel. The ads had been purchased. Everyone was signed off on it. It had gone through a review process. Then we got our first letter from Monsanto.
So at first, the story you presented, Fox was very happy with it. They thought it was a really good story, and they were going to air it.
Well, I guess the first real issue was whether or not it was a story, and now four years ago, when the government approved the use of bovine growth hormone in the nation's dairy herd, there was a lot of protest, a lot of scientific protest, a lot of consumer protest, and many big supermarket chains, including Safeway and Vons, and here in Florida, Publix and Albertsons. They all said that because of the protest, they weren't going to buy milk from these cows that had been treated with a hormone. And the first issue was that promise kept? And what Jane found from visiting seven big dairy farms at random in the state of Florida was that all seven were using it, and it was in the milk supply throughout the state of Florida and, we believe, through much of the country. So once they found that out, it was a terrific story until, as Jane pointed out, Monsanto hired a very high-powered lawyer in New York to represent them and write a letter to Roger Ailes, who is the former Republican operative who is now head of Fox News, and they put the pressure on Mr. Ailes big time, and then after that, their interest in the story suddenly waned.
Talk, if you will, about the letter and what happened after the receipt of that.
It was quite some letter. In fact, there were two letters. The first letter came on the eve of the broadcast, as Jane said, and it essentially said, of course I'm paraphrasing, that this was a very complicated issue, and these two reporters that you had go look into it obviously aren't smart enough to really understand what the truth of the matter is. And it's been approved by the federal government, therefore we shouldn't have any worries about it. And a lot of other people have said nice things about it. And Monsanto certainly supports it, and therefore, you shouldn't be criticizing it like this. And after the letter came, they postponed the broadcast. The general manager and vice president of the station, who himself was a former investigative reporter, came downstairs, and we had a big meeting, and he looked at it all, and, there just weren't any errors of fact. It was a fair piece, a balanced piece. He said, let's run it. But just to make sure that we're bending over backwards to give them every opportunity to say whatever they want, call them up at Monsanto headquarters and offer to go back to St. Louis a second time, and if they've thought of anything else they want to say, let them say it, and let's put it in the piece even further than we have in the first version. Well, when we called and made that offer, that only put them on notice that their first efforts to kill the story had not been successful, and that's when letter number two arrived. And after both of those letters to Mr. Ailes, that was pretty much the death knell, it seemed, from that point on. Those letters, by the way, and all of these documents we're talking about, just so people don't think we're putting our spin on it, are all posted to a website that we've produced, and we've copied the letters, we've scanned them in, and everybody can look at every word of all of the letters and the memos and the scripts that we wanted to broadcast and what Fox wanted us to broadcast. That's all on a special website, which anybody can visit. We were about to broadcast this on one of 24 television stations that Fox owns. But when the pressure from Monsanto came, it went right to Roger Ailes, who technically had nothing to do with it. But whatever they said to Mr. Ailes, he certainly had the clout to pass the word down.
586.
Towards the end of 1989, a great box of documents arrived at my office without any indication where they came from. And I opened them and found in it a complete set of Monsanto files, particularly a set of files dealing with toxicological testing of cows who've been given RBGH.
BST, trade name Posilac, is being used in more than a quarter of the dairy herds in the United States, according to Monsanto. The milk has been drunk by a large portion of the American population since the Food and Drug Administration declared it safe for both cows and humans 4 years ago.
And at that time, Monsanto was saying, there's no evidence whatsoever of any adverse effects, we don't use antibiotics, and this clearly showed that they had lied through their teeth. The files described areas of chronic inflammation in the heart, lung, kidney, spleen, also reproductive effects, also a whole series of other problems.
There's a cost to the cows. The cows get sicker when they're injected with RBGH. They're injected with antibiotics. We know that people are consuming antibiotics through their food. And we know that that's contributing to antibiotic-resistant bacteria and diseases.
Just to clarify what you said, and that was that people in authority at the station were literally taking what could, I guess, be called Monsanto press release material and information and instructing you to put that in your story and have nothing to counterbalance them.
Yes. That is not all they did. We had a couple of reputable scientists who were very adamant critics of the use of this drug. And, I mean, one of them has 3 medical degrees and is a professor at the University of Illinois and has written 8 books on the environmental causes of cancer. And instead of putting his credentials in there, which we felt was important because this isn't just another cancer scare guy from who knows where. I mean, this is a guy who has a background in this area. This is what his area of expertise is. And we had to reduce him down to a scientist in Chicago. We had to take out reputable, well-credentialed, anything like that that would help explain and put him in context. We also had a fellow in Wisconsin who has developed agricultural chemicals for 30 years, and we had to reduce his credentials down to a scientist in Wisconsin. Now, you know, who is this guy? As a viewer, I want to know, is this guy credible? But we really couldn't tell you that. And there were other things that they did as well.
Talk about what those were.
Well, you know, it was as basic as saying things that were just demonstrably untrue. I mean, it's one thing, and everybody sort of expects that a company, and any company does this, they want to put the most favorable spin, the most favorable interpretation on any kind of a story that they don't like. And that's certainly understandable. But this, as you point out, it went way beyond trying to put their industry-friendly spin. It was telling us to broadcast and to allow them to say, without any contradiction, facts that we knew to be false. There are so many of them, I know we don't have the time to go into, but let me just give you one example of the most basic fact of all that we just said, we will never do this because it's wrong. They wanted the report to convey to the viewer that there is no difference between a glass of milk from a cow that was treated with this artificial hormone and a cow that had not had the injections of bovine growth hormone. They wanted us to give the viewer the impression by letting Monsanto say there's no difference in the milk. Now, there is a difference in the milk, and it's an important difference in the milk. Levels of a chemical called IGF-1, insulin-like growth factor, which is a known promoter of cancer, breast cancer, colon cancer, prostate cancer, the levels of IGF-1 are much higher and more potent in the milk from a cow injected with artificial hormone than in the milk from a cow that has had no hormone injections. Now, you can argue that the levels aren't significant. You can argue that, yeah, they're higher, but it won't really hurt you. You can put whatever spin on that you want to, but it is wrong, it's misleading, it's inaccurate, it's unfair to say to the viewer and let the viewer walk away from the broadcast thinking there's really no difference in the milk. That is a perfect example of the kinds of inaccuracies and distortions that they insisted we do.
673. That recording was from over a decade ago, so there is a sad and perhaps unsurprising postscript there. After years of legal battle, it turned out that they weren't whistleblowers in the eyes of the law, because whistleblowers blow the whistle on a crime, and no crime had been committed. Fox News claimed they had a First Amendment right to state their opinion, including when that was mendacious. So if they wanted to lie and distort the truth, then they had a right to do it. Don't we have policies about this, telling companies they shouldn't be lying? Well, yes, we do, but somehow we don't have laws. And that was the finding after the Fox News legal team got to work, that whistleblowing is about breaking laws and regulations, whereas the FCC only had a policy. So, if Fox News want to break a policy, then they have a First Amendment right to do that. That was a legal argument, and it stuck, leaving Steve Wilson and Jane Acree with no compensation and very large expenses. They had to pay the legal bills.
301.
It was in 1988 when my friend Jeremy Rifkin asked me to organize farmers and consumers against Monsanto's genetically engineered cow hormone that I really began to learn about the public relations industry. And of course, public relations is, you know, actually it's a euphemism for propaganda. And it was a term coined by Eddie Bernays, the father of the public relations industry, because in the United States and Western democracies, we're supposed to believe we don't have propaganda. Propaganda is a dirty term. It's a pejorative that connotes Stalin's Russia or Hitler's Germany. We have, you know, well-educated, skeptical to the point of cynical citizenry. We have an independent, investigative, free press. And certainly, if there were any organization or cabal or conspiracy or governmental or corporate entity intent on managing our perceptions through propaganda, we'd all know about it. Of course, the irony is, as Alex Carey pointed out and other academics who've made it a point of studying propaganda, that it's actually in countries like the United States where we have the most propaganda. Because in brutal dictatorships, whether it's, you know, Saddam's Iraq or Guatemala after the U.S. overthrew the government in 1954, or whether we're talking Stalin's Russia or Hitler's Germany, absolute brutal oppression works pretty well to control the populace. It's really in countries like ours where you need a very sophisticated, hidden method of persuasion and control. And in fact, here in the United States, it's become a huge business, advertising and especially the hidden manipulation of public relations. The gentleman I mentioned, Alex Carey, isn't known to most Americans. He really wasn't known to me until a friend of mine, Bob McChesney, gave me a book of Alex Carey's that's now available in the U.S. It wasn't yet then, titled Taking the Risk Out of Democracy. And Carey was a friend and a collaborator with Noam Chomsky. He was an Australian, and he studied corporate propaganda. And Alex Carey wrote something in this posthumously published book that I think really is a touchstone. It's a touchstone for our work, but I think it also, when you hear it, you'll see that it's a touchstone for really comprehending what's going on right now in our world. Carey wrote, "The 20th century has been characterized by three developments of great political importance: the growth of democracy, the growth of corporate power, and the growth of corporate propaganda as a means of protecting corporate power against democracy." And then he went on to explain how, in a democracy, it's advertising, but especially public relations, through which propaganda is waged. So when I was asked by my friend Jeremy Rifkin to get involved in this effort around bovine growth hormone, it was obvious to me that companies like Monsanto that were developing this drug were colluding with the Food and Drug Administration and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the regulatory agencies that supposedly protect animal health and protect food safety, and that rather than investigating this drug and regulating it or keeping it off the market as they should have done, they were helping Monsanto and the other firms promote the drug. And I did a Freedom of Information Act investigation that got for me thousands of pages of internal documents, mind-blowing, showing, for instance, that the American Medical Association and the American Dietetic Association had already been brought into this campaign to front for this drug even before it was approved. At the same time, I got a call from a very nice woman who said she heard that I was organizing a meeting in Washington, D.C. of groups who were concerned about bovine growth hormone, and she was with a group called Maryland Citizens Consumer Council, and would they be able to come to the meeting? They were housewives, they had kids, and they didn't want their kids drinking milk from cows injected with this drug. They wanted them to be able to choose in the marketplace and not have to drink it in schools if it were approved. So I invited her to, of course, participate. We had our meeting, and there were groups like Consumers Union and National Farmers Union, National Family Farm Coalition, some state legislators. A couple weeks later, and this was in October 1990, I got a call from John Dillon, who's still a reporter in Vermont, and he said, you know, Monsanto's bragging that they had a spy in your meeting. Any idea who that might be? And, of course, I knew who it was right away. It was this wonderful young woman, Diane Moser, because she was the only person who wasn't known to us. So I did some sleuthing and discovered that, indeed, Diane Moser, unlike another person from her group who contacted us, was her real name. And she and the other person both worked for the Burson Marsteller public relations firm. The Maryland Citizens Consumer Council didn't exist. And Burson Marsteller, one of the world's largest PR firms, was employed by Monsanto and the other companies developing this drug. And she was essentially a spy to infiltrate our meeting and report back. And, of course, I was outraged. And then in the documents I was obtaining under the Freedom of Information Act, I was finding that another firm called Direct Impact did a similar sort of spy operation with money from the USDA to discredit a farmer-organized conference in New York. I was just blown away, and I realized, you know, there's something wrong here. So I began to investigate, and what really dawned on me was that this is how every single important issue is managed.
I think John Stauber makes a very important point there, simple though it is, that what may appear to us as an anomaly, a glitch in the matrix, something unusual, is actually just business as usual. It's one more occasion when professional deceivers have to reach for the playbook, get out some of their strategies, and go about their regular business of hiding the truth. And if I hadn't been busy on the Encyclopedia of Deep Politics for the last few years, I wouldn't have realized just what a routine situation this is, whether we're talking about a fake justification for a war, for an assassination that needs to be made to look like a death from natural causes, or a plane crash that needs to be explained, then it's just one more job for perceptions management. And on the subject of plane crashes, we continue with episode 682.
Christina Borgeson, journalist and producer, in CBS from 1994 to 97.
There are what I call black holes in journalism. There are certain events and certain subjects that you may not cover.
On the night of July 17th, 1996, flight TWA 800 was en route from New York City to Paris, carrying 230 passengers, when disaster struck.
Bringing you up to date, a TWA flight, a 747 aircraft, has gone down.
That day I was at CBS, and my executive producer called me down and told me to look into it. And it completely changed my life, shifted my paradigm.
As Borgeson investigated the crash for CBS News, many people reported something disturbing they'd seen in the night sky.
All these eyewitnesses said they'd seen something go up, then they followed it up to where the plane was, and then all of a sudden the plane exploded.
With different reports emerging about TWA 800, the FBI declared the surrounding area a crime scene.
If it is a terrorist event, we then have the challenge to find out who the perpetrators were, who the cowards were that did this.
As Navy divers were called to recover the plane's wreckage, rumors of friendly fire emerged.
That first FBI press conference I went to, some guy raised his hand and he said, "Why is the Navy involved in the recovery when they are suspect?"
There's a video of the FBI press conference, and there's a chap with a sign which says, "We demand an independent people's investigation, World Workers' Party."
Kallstrom just pointed at him and he goes, "Remove him!"
And indeed, he is manhandled out of the meeting by a group of about five men acting in concert. Just as a piece of background on how plane crashes are investigated, there's no one body that's responsible. The NTSB looks, and if it determines that a criminal act has taken place, then it hands over the investigative control to the FBI. So that effectively allows the US deep state two different points of intervention. If it can't control the NTSB, it has a second bite at the cherry when it attempts to control the FBI.
And then everybody continued as if this hadn't happened. And to my mind, we should have all pressed on that question.
The military, that friendly fire was not involved in this incident. And I used the strongest terms I could use. I said it was highly, 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 highly unlikely.
Despite FBI denials, Borgeson's research uncovered a different scenario based on the Navy's activity on the night of the disaster.
When they released the radar information, they only gave half of it. They cut it off right when you could see that there were all these military vessels in this exercise zone that was right there.
Kelly O'Meara, congressional aide, New York, 1981-97.
Not only were there ships there, but there actually was a live fire exercise going on off the coast that night. And that's why they had closed down the flight corridor that is parallel to the commercial flight path. When there's a distress, you're supposed to, by law of the sea, go and try and help. These ships went in the absolute opposite direction, away from the crash site and at 30 knots.
The search for clear-cut evidence continued, and Borgeson was offered a piece of seat fabric from the plane that had undergone preliminary testing.
The test had revealed that there were heavy metals in it that were consistent with a missile strike that went through the plane at a certain point where this seat was very close to. And Christina received a sample to do independent verification.
I mean, it was just amazing. How many times do you get hard evidence from something? I had no idea there was going to be any problem whatsoever.
As CBS News gave Borgeson the go-ahead to accept the seat fabric, she was close to discovering whether a missile strike had brought down the plane.
And I was looking around for a lab, and that's when the FBI called and said, "You have a piece of stolen evidence." To my great disappointment and dismay, CBS just gave it right back.
CBS has given federal investigators a piece of cloth purportedly from the downed TWA Flight 800. The FBI wanted the fabric because...
CBS folded like an ice cube in the sun. They just went. They decided this is not a story we're going to fight for. It was a great moment of spinelessness on the corporate media's part.
No evidence
has been found which would indicate that a criminal act was the cause of the tragedy of TWA Flight 800. The law enforcement team has looked at every theory and has left no stone unturned.
With eyewitness accounts of a possible missile strike still unexplained, the CIA produced an animation that was broadcast nationally.
Now, I find that very interesting. I wonder, has anybody asked the CIA how they got involved? What was the purpose of making an animation and repeatedly broadcasting it on television? Did that somehow relate to the investigation? I do also recall a statement in a newspaper taken out as a private advertisement, something along the lines of, "We, 250 concerned citizens, saw what looked like a missile, and we thought somebody should be told. No one was very interested in what we had to say, so here it is, we're putting it in print as a private advertisement."
When they showed that animation, it wasn't like they then went out and talked to the fishing boat captain who had seen something completely different.
Flames visible to eyewitnesses more than 40 miles away.
I did. And they said, "This is ridiculous. This is not describe what I saw."
As the aircraft descended, it produced an increasingly visible fire.
The video was shown on network TV. It was shown nationally. It was shown over and over.
To date, there is no evidence that any eyewitness saw a missile shoot down TWA Flight 800.
The press bought it. The press bought the government's version of events.
At the time of the disaster, Westinghouse, a nuclear power company and major defense contractor, owned CBS News.
Any logical person would go, well, where does the vast majority of their money come from? Government contracting. If Christina were getting too close to the truth, would they shut down the investigation or would they lose their government contracts? I mean, these are logical questions that you have to wonder. What's more important to CBS?
Ultimately, Borgeson's pursuit of what happened that night challenged the priorities of corporate media.
I walked into this meeting of news executives. I said, "Why aren't we covering this?" And one guy looks up at me and he goes, "Oh, you think it's a missile, don't you?" And I said, "I don't know what it is, but I'll tell you, it's not a straightforward thing. There's something going on here." And there was just this silence, and I was just looking out at this sea of white shirts. And as I turned around and left, I just thought, God, you know, my goose is cooked here. And it was, you know. I was out a few weeks later.
672.
The whole prosecution against me was controlled by Kroll, the private security company. Bill Bratton, he was perceived as by the media as a super cop, came over from the States. He's now advising the Home Office on policing matters. He's the chairman of Kroll, and literally they're very, very influential. There was a Private Eye article recently about MI6 connections with Kroll, huge organizations, and they literally took control of the whole prosecution against me. And the email trail literally shows Kroll making suggestions to the police. This is what we want you to do. This is how we want it done. And City of London Police, using their counterterrorism directorate, bowed to the might of this almighty private security company.
Right. Now, this is just to reinforce it for viewers. We're not talking hearsay or guessing.
No, this is fact. This happened in my case.
These were documents that were produced in court.
Absolutely.
And those documents were showing Kroll, as a private company, was directing counter-terrorism police on the ground. How much of the detail of this did the BBC
Nothing. They didn't touch it at all. They've seen it all.
Nothing. So, there's nowhere we can go to where a BBC source or programme shows that £1 million worth of state money was putting 25.
And that a private security company was directing counterterrorism as officers.
So the BBC didn't report that. BBC did come up with a very detailed programme of jihad.
237.
In Britain too, the government and most of the media have created an overwhelming impression that there is a hidden network of Al-Qaeda sleeper cells waiting to attack.
Ask you to move back, please.
But yet again, there is very little evidence for this. Of the 664 people arrested under the Terrorism Act since September the 11th, none of them have been convicted of belonging to Al-Qaeda. Only three people have so far been convicted of having any association with any Islamist groups. and none of those convictions were for being involved with a terror plot. They were for fundraising or possessing Islamist literature.
We'll get back to them later. Meanwhile, take a mental note that the terrorists were found guilty of owning Islamic literature and of fundraising.
The majority of people convicted under the Terrorism Act since September the 11th have actually been members of Irish terrorist groups, like the UVF or the Real IRA. And many of the arrests that were dramatically announced as being part of a hidden Al-Qaeda network were in reality as absurd as the cases in America. For example, the London police swooped on a Mr. Zainal Ubadin, who they said was running an international network for terrorist training. It turned out to be a self-defense course for bodyguards. He called Ultimate Jihad Challenge. His only client was a security guard from a supermarket who wanted to learn how to defend himself against shoplifters. Mr. Zainal Ubadin was cleared of all charges. Then there was the Hogmanay terror cell, who it was alleged were planning to attack Edinburgh. All charges against them were quietly dropped when it was revealed that a key part of the evidence, a map which showed the targets they were going to attack, turned out to have been left in their flat by an Australian backpacker who had ringed the tourist sites he wanted to see. And even the most frightening and high profile of the plots uncovered turned out to be without foundation. No one was ever arrested for planning gas attacks on the London tubes. It was a fantasy that swept through the media. Just as in America, there is no evidence yet of the terrifying and sinister network lurking under the surface of our society, which both government and the media continually tell us is there.
So the newspapers can fill pages on jihad and what's happening with young Muslims, but when it comes to your story, all of a sudden terrorism stops it going into the paper.
This is a classic. I was camping. I put a tent up and I was camping opposite Parliament with all of the peace and war protesters and all the people that were doing their various things there with a big banner, £1.4 million spent by counter-terrorism police on a plumber, because that's what I am. And the press were there because obviously they were following the activists there. The BBC were down on a regular basis. Got to see Donal McIntyre, you know, hard-hitting investigative journalist, and nobody would pick up the story. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it.
You've got to end these things. You've got to look around you. You've got to see. You've got to try and understand, because behind the lies there's a bigger plan. And the people that run them bigger plan don't give a damn. You understand? It's madness on the streets. Don't just watch the BBC and take their word for it. What about all the stories they've not told? The third face of power. The one that you can't see, that stops stories getting into the news so you don't understand the truth. You don't understand reality because you're hooked on the fiction. Listen to my diction, listen to
226.
Samuel Bush, who was Prescott's father, was a war profiteer in World War I. And I think when you add it all up, there is a relevance that ought to be part of the public debate. I consider them to be a family of war profiteers and war criminals that have never been brought to justice properly. I originally was so shocked by what I had found that I didn't even try to write the story myself. I figured I was in way over my head as a freelance journalist from Miami. So I tried to play like Daniel Ellsberg and just leak the documents or give them away. And I offered them exclusively to the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, and the three major television networks. And they wouldn't even look at the documents, much less report the story. And this information had been covered up for 70 years. It had just been expunged from the public record. It didn't exist anywhere in any way that, you know, mattered. And so, lo and behold, I ended up writing the stories myself and publishing them in the New Hampshire Gazette, which is the oldest newspaper in America, and gave Samuel Adams his first byline in 1756. Those stories, in turn, largely thanks to the Internet, ran all over the world in about 80 countries and made the front page of Pravda and Haaretz in Israel and, you know, papers all over the world. But the story has never really gotten out to the extent that it should have. And if the American people really knew the extent of the criminality of the Bush family going back 100 years, I don't think that either Bush would have been elected president, frankly. I have in my possession documents that not only show that Prescott Bush was a shareholder, a stockholder in Union Banking Corporation, but a colleague of mine, a German journalist named Eva Schweitzer, earlier this year went to Columbia University and found Prescott Bush's actual diaries in his own handwriting, where he talks about his day-to-day management of this web of Thiessen-controlled Nazi front businesses. The grandfather and great-grandfather of the President of the United States today were guilty of treason and should have been tried for treason for giving aid and comfort to our enemy in a time of war. And not only were they not tried for treason, but this information has been largely covered up for 70 years.
The unspeakable.
Can you give us some idea of the influence that the CIA and the FBI have had over the media?
The Church Committee.
That's the Senate committee that looked into illegal intelligence gatherings in 1975.
The Church Committee reported that the CIA had thousands of journalists in their employ. They also owned, outright, the CIA, about 250 or more media organizations, wire services, newspapers, magazines, radio, TV stations. The actual shareholder of the company turned out to be some CIA front. Every city of any size on Earth had some employee. They could get their stories anywhere.
Merriman Smith, who recently killed himself, won a Pulitzer Prize for reporting the assassination. He reports that he was riding under the underpass when he heard the shots that killed our young president, which is interesting since he was two cars behind Kennedy, and Kennedy never reached the underpass. He was killed well ahead of it, and possibly from it. So that man was given a Pulitzer Prize. Now that distortion and that perversion of our values, that madness of leaking information, and of the intelligence community running hog wild with a blank check.
They could get their stories anywhere.
And there are ways to make sure stories don't come out. Dorothy Kilgallen became the first nationally known journalist to raise critical questions about the JFK assassination and the government cover-up. She printed story after story of witnesses who had been threatened by the Dallas police or the FBI.
Intelligence agencies will be watching us. We'll have to be very careful, but if it's the last thing I do, I'm going to break this case. This story isn't going to die as long as there's a real reporter alive, and there are a lot of them.
Dorothy Kilgallen died on November 8, 1965, in her Manhattan bedroom from a lethal overdose of secobarbital, amobarbital, and pentobarbital. Quinine, which might have covered the bitter taste of the barbiturates, was found in her brain, bile, and liver. That fact, however, was not reported in the official lab findings presented to the Department of Pathology.
And it's not just control of the media by the intelligence community. Noam Chomsky, linguist and media critic.
The media serve the interests of state and corporate power, which are closely interlinked. They frame their reporting and analysis in a manner supportive of established privilege, and they limit debate and discussion accordingly.
Journalist and author Jim Mars, in his book Crossfire, lists over 100 names of potential witnesses to JFK's assassination that died or were killed, many of them under suspicious circumstances. Adrienne Rich, poet and feminist.
Whatever is unnamed, whatever is misnamed is something else. Whatever is buried under an inadequate or lying language, this will become not merely unspoken, but unspeakable.
I found this an insightful quote because it encapsulates in a very few words one of the understandings that I have only gradually worked my way towards as I have been making these shows over the years. What inspired me to devote 3 of the last 4 episodes to these enemy images which are promulgated by the media. Somewhere I think I knew that the difference between terrorism and terrorization is the difference between them and us. That is to say, a difference only of perspective. It was obvious to me, in terms of terrorism, why our bombs are good bombs, their bombs are bad bombs. That hypocrisy is easy to see. I think the same insight is useful applied to a lot of language which is repeatedly used by corporate media, such as, for example, freedom and democracy, the free market. Who's free? To what extent? What are they free to do? What are they not free to do? Having, I think, made the case that corporate media is a tool of those who run the deep state, let's take a look and see to what ends that tool has been applied. Is that perhaps engaging in a desperate rearguard action to try to shore up some of the social consensus that things have to be the way they are, that however much suffering is currently manifest, if we keep going down this road, somehow we will reach a glorious corporate utopia. So let's hear Lynn Gerry. This is from episode 307.
Capitalism is called the free market, but it's not about free or freedom. It's about creating scarcity through law. For example, people are not homeless because there are no homes. They are homeless because they have no money to buy or rent homes, and are denied access by law for the same reason to vacant land where they could gather materials and build a home for themselves. Even a rat living in a city sewer has more freedom to live than most of the people in the city above who are under this so-called free market system. In order for capitalists to get profits, they have to sell more and more of something to somebody somewhere. There are a limited number of people with the money to buy new cars and big-screen TVs. In order to create new investment opportunities, capitalists seek to create, through law, the means to force people to enter the market by making them pay for what they once had freely. This is one of the motives behind the so-called free trade agreements. Access to fresh water is the new profit frontier, and the hammer has already come down hard in the global south. In India, Coca-Cola established a bottling plant that extracted so much water from the aquifer that the residents' wells have run dry. And the WTO treaties gave Coca-Cola the right to do this under the rubric of free trade. In Bolivia, one of the things that led to the recent election of President Evo Morales was a war over water. A previous corrupt government privatized the water in the city of Cochabamba and gave ownership of it to the U.S.-based Bechtel Corporation, which was supposed to provide water services. As a result, residents were forced to pay Bechtel for water, and even collecting rain from their roof became illegal. Unbelievable, but true. And Bechtel then jacked up the water rates to figures amounting to half the monthly income of many families. The people rose up, threw out Bechtel, and now, under the WTO rules, Bechtel is demanding billions of dollars from Bolivia for their lost profit.
428.
The Industrial Revolution, which comes in the last half of the 18th century in Britain, intensified the magnitude of that human assault on ecosystems and human beings' assaults on each other. It unleashed the concentrated energy of coal, oil, natural gas. It created a machine-based world, which has admittedly produced unparalleled material comfort for some. And whatever one thinks of the effects of that material comfort, and I think at best it's a kind of mixed story, the processes that produce that comfort are literally destroying the capacity of the ecosystem to sustain human life as we know it into the future. And in the present, those comforts produced by that are clearly not distributed in a fashion that is consistent with any meaningful conception of justice in any system, theological or secular philosophical system. So what this means is these first two revolutions have left us in a place where we live in a way that's in direct conflict with common sense and our own stated principles. So the question is, how did we get to this place? And I think the answer has something to do with what I want to call the delusional revolution, which is the term I use for the development of very sophisticated propaganda techniques in the 20th century, especially a very highly emotive and image-based advertising system that have produced in the bulk of the population, especially first world societies, a distinctly delusional state of being. And even those of us who try to resist it often can't help but be drawn into the delusion in certain ways. And as a culture, we end up collectively acting as if unsustainable systems can be sustained, simply because we want them to be. If you think about it, much of the storytelling in this culture, and storytelling is how we come to understand the world in so many ways, particularly the dominant storytelling institutions, which are the mass media, they all remain committed to maintaining this delusional state, and it becomes very hard to extract oneself from the story.
Let's just hear that one more time.
The dominant storytelling institutions, which are the mass media, they all remain committed to maintaining this delusional state, and it becomes very hard to extract oneself from the story.
Now, that provides another angle on why 25 years ago I turned off television for good, and why I found my way here to Bangladesh, a country where people are still much more interested in the real world and in what their neighbours have to say than in official announcements by the government or through the newspapers. Now, yes, that is changing with the coming of smartphone technology and so forth. Let's just recall that quote by Adrian Rich.
Whatever is buried under an inadequate or lying language, this will become not merely unspoken, but unspeakable.
So Thomas Merton gave us the phrase, the unspeakable, which is a phrase that I would refer to as the US deep state, the criminal government, as Mike Rupert put it. Working on WikiSpooks has convinced me of the centrality of language. If we don't have a vocabulary to describe what's going on, how can we talk about it? And on the internet, how can we meet up with other people who are talking about it? And one of the ways that the deep state has remained hidden for as long as it has is if it has to admit corruption on a government level by the use of misleading metaphors such as bad apples. The integrity and good intent of the system as a whole is never subject to question in corporate media. How could it be? They don't have the language. Hence my attention to language as a first step towards grappling with the phenomenon. Now, don't infer, by the way, from my usage of the phrase deep state, that I'm necessarily in agreement with the meaning of the phrase as used by corporate media. In a way, it would be surprising if I were. So, just to clarify, I don't necessarily think there's a great overarching conspiracy, at least not at this stage. This is something that is very US-centric. Let's hear, to clarify that point, the introduction of episode 719, The Processes and Logic of the Deep State.
I do not posit that there has been a secret conspiracy to take over the government. I think there are processes. Nobody really controls it. People at certain moments made some key decisions. I think they were always ad hoc things, not like this is step one in establishing the deep state. It was just, no, the president has to go. These are processes. The instruments are there, the machinery is there, the personnel keep changing. But once these processes are in motion, then they acquire their own logic. For example, if the governing media of this country commit themselves to the position that the president was killed by a lone nut, then they're committed to lying for eternity, really. For them to tell the truth about the Kennedy assassination would mean to have to say we participated in a lie for the public good, but nonetheless a lie.
Now, the point about momentum of these processes is well taken. I think we should bear that in mind any time there is discussion about do we need a new generation of artificially intelligent flying laser-guided drones or any of these new autonomous killing technologies. If we think now landmines are unacceptable, they pose an indiscriminate threat to the future, how much more so this modern technology? We continue with a short section from The Power of Nightmares, an Adam Curtis film we adapted for episode 235.
In the past, politicians promised to create a better world. They had different ways of achieving this, but their power and authority came from the optimistic visions they offered their people. Those dreams failed, and today people have lost faith in ideologies. Increasingly, politicians are seen simply as managers of public life. But now, they have discovered a new role that restores their power and authority. Instead of delivering dreams, politicians now promise to protect us from nightmares. They say that they will rescue us from dreadful dangers that we cannot see and do not understand. And the greatest danger of all is international terrorism, a powerful and sinister network with sleeper cells in countries across the world. A threat that needs to be fought by a war on terror. But much of this threat is a fantasy, which has been exaggerated and distorted by politicians. It's a dark illusion that has spread unquestioned through governments around the world, the security services, and the international media. This is a series of films about how and why that fantasy was created, and who it benefits.
That single question, who it benefits, is one that is notable in its absence from the modern dialogue about what is called terrorism. I consider the modern terrorist phenomenon inseparable from global capitalism. For more on this, let's hear from John McMurtry. We're going to hear a set of clips from I Kill, Therefore I Am, episode 222, broadcast back in 2004.
The ruling market group mind is regulated by the following set of principles to which all of official culture conforms without question, including our own. One, pursuit in a market order of maximal monetary assets and commodities for oneself is natural for humans, rational in all places and times, necessary for all social progress and development.
542.
I know this is not an issue that we talk about too much. Collectively, the 400 richest Americans have accumulated $1.27 trillion in wealth. How much more do they want? When is enough enough? Do you want it all?
Two, there is no rightful limit on acquisition of these market assets and all things, or any countervailing right to redistribution of their holdings, however unequal they become.
556.
I had worked for a great many years on a tendency for more equal countries, that's countries with smaller income differences between rich and poor, to be healthier. But I was very slow to realize that that might apply not just to ill health, which is more common in the poorest areas of our society, but to a whole range of other social problems which have the same pattern. So we're going to take you through that data. The differences are extraordinarily large. I mean, you find huge differences in homicide rates and drug abuse and child well-being and so on from one rich country to another. And that is partly because these effects of inequality don't just affect the poor. They affect almost all of us to different degrees. And so what we're really talking about is the real quality of life for the vast majority of the populations now in the rich developed countries.
However unequal they become. Leo Strauss, the man behind the National Security Council for years in the U.S., the theoretician, says that limitless accumulation of private capital is the highest moral duty. Three, freedom to buy and sell and self-maximizing transactions of money and price commodities is the basis of all human liberty and justice, and there is no outer limit in its rightful globalization. Four, The market's money price system always optimally allocates resources and distributes goods and services in each and every society to ensure the best of all possible worlds.
183.
One of the first projects introduced into India at the time of the new economic policies that were based on trade liberalization, globalization, or the imposition, you know, basically the neoliberal policies, was a World Bank loan to introduce industrial shrimp farming along the 7,000-kilometer coastline of India. It's not the case that we haven't farmed shrimp before. In Kerala, there has been an ancient system called Cheminketu, brilliant system, in which in the monsoon, when the waters come, the water is used for growing paddy because the salinity is low. And in the rest of the year, when the salinity goes high, those same ponds and lakes are used to grow shrimp. The biomass left from the rice gives food to the shrimp in the next season. And the droppings from the shrimp give fertilizer to the rice. So without any external input, perennially you can keep the cycle of shrimp and rice going. Well, it was considered as low productivity because shrimp was the high global commodity, whereas the rice was used by local people. So the World Bank gave huge loans, and before we knew it, the entire coast was pockmarked with these industrial ponds. And, you know, water is supposed to go from the land to the sea, but now water was being brought to the, from the sea to the land so that you could set up these seawater ponds to put the shrimp in. And then because they want to produce more shrimp, they've got to give intensive feed. And it's such a wasteful process. 15 times more fish is used to feed the shrimp than is produced. 87% of that feed is pollution. And that pollution is then thrown back into the sea that kills the rest of the sea life, kills the creeks. In addition, you've brought salt water on the land, which starts to leach out. And before you know, it's killing your paddy fields, it's killing your coconut groves, it's killing all life around. And the women of the coastal area started a campaign in which I helped them. We got a Supreme Court order to ban this activity. And again, this whole issue of poverty and development came up because the figures thrown up by the industry, by the bank, were the trade figures of what was traded when shrimp was brought to your tables. What was never talked about was the figures of the destruction of what was left behind. And we did those studies for the Supreme Court case. For every dollar traded in shrimp, $10 of destruction was left in the local economy and the local ecology. For every job created in the shrimp industry, 15 livelihoods were destroyed in the local economy. And one could do this for every activity that's supposed to bring commercial activity, therefore growth, therefore supposedly a removal of poverty. But out of situations where people are meeting their needs, it creates a combination of dispossession and displacement, of real poverty. At the end of it, what you have is a situation where ordinary communities who could have met their needs, were meeting their needs, are now economic, social, and ecological refugees.
The market's money price system always optimally allocates resources and distributes goods and services in each and every society to ensure the best of all possible worlds. Five, I mean, this is all deducible for our axiomatized in neoclassical theory. Money profit maximization by investors is the ultimate engine of economic and social advance and is maximally liberated from the dead hand of state regulation.
572.
The biggest industries today, the multinationals, are not interested so much in efficiency in production or competition at price or product level, but they are competing at the government level.
Forget about stocks. Forget about bonds. There's a lucrative new investment arena. Legislation. A good mutual fund might return 20% a year, but in the low-risk, high-return world of legislation, your investment dollar can return over 100,000%.
Drive a blast. billionaires are here, we're men of the hour. We're sitting pretty chilling in the hall of power. We're buying access, seeing progress, and making a mess of the political process. Oh yes, our cheese is buying us a whole lot of leverage.
Here's how it works. With the help of a professional legislation broker called a lobbyist, you place your investment, called a campaign contribution,
to regulate in of all corporations and our industries. We're the boxes with the platinum set of henhouse keys, buying billion-dollar favors for a couple of G's.
With a carefully selected list of legislation manufacturers called members of Congress.
We're just living our American dream. The CEOs are playing for the Bush-Cheney team. My president, he got you all scared. The billionaires are coming, so you better beware.
They go to work, crafting industry-specific subsidies, inserting tax breaks into the tax code, or giving away public property for free. The effect on your bottom line is immediate and huge.
For a paltry $5 million in campaign contributions, we here at the broadcasting industry were able to secure free digital TV licenses worth $70 billion. That's an incredible 1,400,000% return on our investment.
We brought Nigerian officials making energy deals. We say Bush is our president. You know we ain't kidding. He's taking our money and doing our bid. You want to win the game, you gotta make the rules. We stole an election right in front of you fools. Our terror alert system got you on your knees while we're picking your pockets and snatching your cheese.
If you could get this kind of return when you buy a bunch of congressmen, just imagine what you can get when you buy the president. Don't wait, invest now, and let the paybacks roll in for the next 4 years.
The billionaires are in the White House.
Us folks at the tobacco industry spent $30 million in campaign contributions for a tax break worth $50 billion. The return on our investment, 167,000%.
ExxonMobil is in the house.
In the White House.
Philip Morris is in the house.
In the White House.
Monsanto is in the house.
In the White House.
This administration's preoccupation is directing the nation on wealth consolidation. All those taxes that you pay, they'll be coming our way. I'm on a platinum tray, so don't play.
Paid for by billionaires for Bush or Gore, because it doesn't really matter who you vote for. We've already bought them.
They are competing with each other to capture control of the levers of government so they can then use the power structure of government to eliminate or hinder their competition.
6. Government intervention, therefore, in the self-regulating market is wrong unless it supports the market system, and dictatorial in proportion to replacement of free market flows of market commodities and capital. 7. Individual consumer desires are permanently increasing and unlimited in their growth by human nature, and are what all free people want more to satisfy. 8. The public interest in human welfare are only increased by a market economy which produces all that is good, including democracy, poverty alleviation, and human civilization. Market growth is therefore beneficial in all places and time, with no limit to the conversion of planetary and human life organization into more priced goods for consumers and profits for firms.
455.
The more that you have automobile accidents, the more growth increases. Now, I'd be fairly unlikely, having smashed my car, to come home and say, darling, don't worry about it, we've just contributed to the national income of the country. I mean, I wouldn't run my household like that, and I can't think like that. I would consider that a loss, you know. I would kind of consider that a debit in my account. A cost, not a benefit. National income accounting doesn't have a debit side. As long as the activity passes through the market, it's good for growth. Let me give you a very easy example. The voyage of the Exxon Valdez. Now, the Exxon Valdez is most likely the most productive oil tanker voyage ever known on the face of the planet. Now, if it had simply loaded up its oil in Alaska and made its way down the West Coast and discharged into a bunker, it would have been a moderately productive voyage in economic terms. But if you want to have fantastic growth, it's a very good idea to ram your tanker into an iceberg.
The point that Marilyn Waring is making there is, whatever people's good intentions, if they are persuaded to don the economic spectacles and look at the world in terms of money, in terms of cash flows, then some very bizarre outcomes manifest. This seems to me to be one of the key lies that Adrian Rich is getting to with that quote, the unspeakable difference between what is a higher number on paper and therefore subject to all manner of programming, optimization of impersonal decision-making processes so beloved by corporations, governments, and other such large organizations, and the well-being, health, and happiness of individuals. Does this perhaps give us some clue as to why depression is rampant in the so-called economically developed societies? If we treat the non-moneyed, indigenous peoples, the other life forms, as if they have no value because they have no money, then this is a license for global destruction. Not in the abstract, sadly, this is going on around us. Let's hear another summary from episode 52.
What this is all about is the basic principle of putting people and the environment before corporate profits and respecting democracy and sovereignty. And I know that sounds simplistic, but in a very real sense, that's the issue. And it's important that we understand that when we hear talk about trade deals, that in many respects, these deals aren't about trade at all. They're about global corporate power and transferring that power from elected representatives at all levels of government, whether it be the civic level, the provincial level, or the national level, into the hands of transnational corporations and secret tribunals who are accountable to nobody. Every so often, we hear that agenda explicitly being named. Michael Walker from the Fraser Institute, for example, said this about trade. He said, a trade deal simply limits the ability to which any signatory government may respond to pressure from their citizens. Think about that. I mean, you don't usually get it as clear as that, do you? As explicit as that. And yet that's really what it's about. Or the other one that I love, because it's the same kind of, you got to sort of grudgingly admit, honesty, even though it's obscene. The former head of the WTO, Renato Ruggiero, said this. He said, there is a surplus of democracy in the world which is interfering with the free movement of capital and investment.
Protection of domestic production of any type is the evil of protectionism, although subsidization of dominant enterprises may be necessary to the national interest.
77.
As you were top economist at the World Bank, why didn't the bank follow your advice? If you challenged land ownership, that would be a change in the power of the elites. That's not high on their agenda. Close quote. Apparently not.
631.
That it appears to be under the direction of certain men and women, but if those people deviate from the system's requirements, out they go. The system has built-in protections, and someone else who will appear to be directing the machine is put into place.
Ultimately, what drove him to put his job on the line was the failure of the banks and the U.S. Treasury to change course when confronted with the crisis. Every time their free market solutions failed, the IMF simply demanded more free market policies. It's a little like the Middle Ages, the insider told me. When the patient died, they would say, well, he stopped the bloodletting too soon. He still had a little blood in him. I took away from my talks with the professor that the solution to world poverty and crisis is simple. Remove the bloodsuckers.
11. Whatever facts of life disaster may seem to contradict the necessity and validity of market principles 1 through 10, the ones I just read, they are always understood as corrected by better application and more rigorous application of market principles. 12. If the creative destruction, as it's called, of the global market destroys old environments and ways of life, these are unavoidable costs of technological progress to be solved by market
Chris
needs.
Hedges from our last episode, 749.
Public lands are opened up to the oil and gas industry, even as rising carbon emissions doom our species. Declining crop yields stemming from heat waves and droughts are ignored. Human societies, if they bow before the dictates of the marketplace, will be ushered into a capitalist paradise. It is only a question of having the right attitude and the right technique. When capitalism thrives, we are assured we thrive.
13. Individuals, groups, or governments which doubt or criticize, and here we get the war drum beginning, the supremacy of the market system, or the inherent efficiency of its production and distribution, or the freedom of its agents, thereby reject the free market and therefore democracy, and are therefore, it follows by transitivity, dangerous to humanity. 14. Any and all societies, parties, or governments which seek any lived alternative, and this is always what they attack, any lived alternative of economic organization, are to the extent of this irrational or evil and must be prevailed over by all means available, including armed force, and I would add 9/11, to protect and advance the free world for all. That's the metaprogram. A simple question tests the hold of these principles. What government, mass medium, or neoclassical economist does not conform to each and all of them? The Bush Jr. administration may be specially extreme in pushing the globalized free market by force of arms on false pretexts, but which of these principles is transgressed in speech or policy by even leaders of this administration's opponents? Who suggests that Iraq should be left free to pursue its own choice of a socialist path?
440.
What was apparent to me from like the lead into it is that whoever made the mistake of calling me that morning didn't really know who I was. They just Googled Blackwater and saw, oh, there's this guy who wrote a book on Blackwater. Get him in here. They start by saying, you know, what is Blackwater? So I start to describe Blackwater, and I'm talking about the connections to the Bush administration and the radical right-wing evangelical Christian that runs the company.
The Bush administration failed to build a coalition of willing nations to occupy Iraq. And so instead, the administration has built a coalition of billing corporations. Right now in Iraq, private personnel on the U.S. government payroll outnumber official U.S. troops. There are about 180,000 so-called private contractors operating alongside 165,000, 170,000 U.S. troops. So really now the U.S. military is the junior partner in this coalition. The mercenary component of that private sector involvement has been totally unaccountable. They operate with impunity. They kill Iraqi civilians. No charges are ever brought against them in Iraqi law, U.S. law, military law.
Why is that, do you think? Do you think that's just an oversight? It slipped through the cracks, the fact that there was a word missing from the military code of justice that allowed these guys to not get charged with anything? Or do you think there was something more intentional about that? As you say, they can't be charged in Iraq, they can't be charged in the U.S., can't be charged at all.
And the fact that what we just saw unfold in Baghdad is not an isolated incident, but this is the latest in a pattern of extrajudicial killings of Iraqis.
Right. I mean, it's hardly an oversight. I mean, either we have tens of thousands of Boy Scouts running around Iraq calling themselves private security, or something is fundamentally rotten with the system. I mean, how can you have tens of thousands of mercenaries operating in Iraq and not a single prosecution? No, this is political expediency on the part of the Bush administration. The deaths of these mercenaries don't get counted in the official U.S. death toll. Their crimes against Iraqis go undocumented and unreported. I mean, this is a shadow war. War is business, and it's very profitable, and Blackwater is doing an incredible job of making itself a lot of money.
The interviewer sort of stops for a moment, and he clearly, I wasn't saying what I was supposed to say, and he said, well, you sound like you're very critical of these companies. You know, journalists aren't supposed to be critical. They're just supposed to tell you the facts, right? And I said, well, yes, and I kept talking, and then he said, well...
And if you're critical of what companies like Blackwater are doing and how they're behaving, what's the alternative?
What he meant to say is, you know, what would your alternative be? Meaning, shouldn't the U.S. military be doing this job? But I, in classic independent media fashion, decided to answer the question that I thought he should have asked, which is, what's the alternative to Blackwater being in Iraq?
Well, I think that the United States needs to withdraw from Iraq, and I believe that the U.S. government needs to pay reparations to the Iraqi people. We hear all of this talk of militias and sectarian violence. Well, what about the militias that the U.S. has deployed in Iraq that are running around the country unaccountable?
You don't say that on CNN. And I think that the host of the show is like a deer.